This is the point where one discusses the inadequacy of what one has done with the material at hand. I've moved quickly through much of it. I avoided Act 3, Scene 4. We haven't even talked really about Act 4. A great work of art is a treasure that just keeps rewarding, and it's the reason why you can go back to it over and over again. And if you're willing to keep studying and exploring, it keeps offering up treasures. So there's much we haven't done with Othello. And when we look at Othello next week, it's an entirely different work. Even though it takes the same story, it's an entirely different work. And what I'm going to do in this last lecture is really just focus on one idea in particular. I want to wrap up our discussion by looking at one aspect of tragedy, which I mentioned, and emphasizing it because I think it's very important in understanding the overall design of the work and where this particular play ends. And what I want to focus upon is the idea that, as I said in my introduction to the play, part of tragedy is that the tragic hero comes to or gains tragic knowledge. So that we are not just left flat. We are not just left with pure emotion. There are things that are learned, finally, at the end. The experience has not been a wasted experience. It may be devastating, it may be horrendous, it may be painful, but, and it's the reason why it seems to me particularly Shakespearean tragedy, is rooted in the Christian faith, from suffering comes knowledge. And that is certainly true in the Shakespeare tragedies. Let me draw a distinction so you have some sense of what I'm talking about. It is possible to have a good play in which awful events unfold, in which we feel great sympathy for the protagonist, and we do not have a tragedy. We do not have a coming to knowledge. I'll use an example that many of you may know about, a recent play, well, recent, 40 years old now, but 50 years old. That's recent enough. And that's Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, which is a good piece of work. It's a powerful stage piece. It's well crafted. We have recognizable characters. We have a human predicament. And we feel great pity as we watch this little man, and he really is a little man, who is crushed by the world around him and the circumstances in which he finds himself. But Miller's assertion that the play is the tragedy of the common man is simply untrue. And I will praise the play. It's a good piece of work. But his assertion for it is not an accurate assertion for a couple of reasons. We don't have a hero. Willie Loman is not heroic. He's a salesman. He's trapped in American materialism. He's not particularly bright, and there's very little that's heroic about him. He's a nice guy that people like. I'm sorry, that's not heroic. Number two, there may be a fall of a kind. He certainly makes a choice, but it's not a tragic choice because it has virtually no ramification outside of his family, his immediate family. It's a family misfortune, and a family misfortune is not tragedy. He goes down without a ripple, and what we're left with, it's small in nature. And as I said before, a real tragedy has repercussions. The fall of Othello, the tragic choice of Othello, has serious repercussions for the state of Venice. Venice suffers because of the choice of one man. Willie Loman's family suffers as the result of the choice of Willie Loman. It's small. But finally, at the end, he has not come to any kind of real knowledge. He is, in a way, a pathetic figure at the end, just as he was a pathetic figure at the beginning, and without that coming to wisdom, again, we don't have tragedy. I don't mean to run down the play. It's a decent play. And if you see it on stage, it's powerful. But it's not tragic. Othello is tragic. What I want to focus on now is that last section of what makes the play tragic, what defines it as tragic, and that is the fact that our hero comes to knowledge, pays a price, but he gains knowledge. And I want to do it by looking closely at three major speeches of Othello in the final scene. The first is the soliloquy that opens Act 5, Scene 2. It's where the final scene begins. Desdemona in the bedchamber, the wedding sheets on the bed, he is coming in at night. He knows what he is going to do. And as he enters the bedchamber and sees her sleeping, the first line, it is the cause, my soul. As he enters, he asserts that he has good reason to do what he's about to do. He begins by asserting this is not a nonsensical act. This is not an act outside the realm of human reason. What is about to take place has a cause, and he connects that cause with his own soul. You'll notice, and Olivier does this very well, as the final scene begins, the man has gotten control over his passion. This is not an outburst. He is trying to be as reasonable and possible as he thinks through what he's about to do. It is the cause, my soul. Let me not name it to you, you chaste stars. It is the cause. The cause is so awful, he will not speak it aloud, and the cause is adultery. He believes that his wife is an adulteress. He won't speak it because the very stars would be offended, the chaste stars. Why are they chaste? They're pure, they're beautiful, they're white. Okay, they have all those characteristics, therefore he will not name it aloud. But, notice, he has made the decision, he is going to kill his wife, but he will not shed her blood. We are going to have, I've got to make the connection, a bloodless sacrifice. And this becomes important by the time we end the speech. He will honor her so, he still feels that there is such beauty there that he will not violate that beauty, he will not suffer her to have her blood spilled. Yet I'll not shed her blood, nor scar that whiter skin of hers than snow and smooth as monumental alabaster. As she lies there, she is beautiful. She is white, white skin against white sheets. And it is a beautiful scene, and he will not soil them, her skin or the sheets, with blood. And she is as white as the stars, she's as white as snow. Notice the coldness, the imagery there. Again, that which is cold, which will come back later in the speech. In a different speech. And finally, as smooth, white and smooth as monumental alabaster. It is as if her very skin is marble, but of course that alabaster was used to make monuments for tombs. And we have a death image there. She looks almost as beautiful as one of those marble sculptures that would be at a tomb. And the death image is on, in the same way that snow comes in the season of death, the death of nature. These are all beautiful images, but notice what they're connected with. They are all images of death. Yet she must die. He's looking at her, he sees the beauty, and then he reminds himself. Yet she must die, else she'll betray more men. I will now prevent her from sinning anymore. And we're back to the earlier line. He has a cause, and it is clear how he is viewing himself now. He is justice. He is the arm of justice. He is, if you will, preserving the social order. Notice what's happening. Not on the battlefield, but in the bedroom. He will preserve the order of society by killing this woman before she betrays more men. Before she engages, it's a fright. He's wrong. But notice the cool, rational analysis of what he's about to do. In the Olivier, they have the light hanging above the bed. Often Othello will come in carrying a candle. And then we get the wonderful line, put out the light, and then put out the light. Kill my wife, who is a light to me, and then put out the candle and exit in darkness. Or, actor's choice, the other way around. Put out the light, extinguish the candle, so that this deed is committed in darkness. It may be an act of justice, but it must be justice done in the dark. Actor's choice. It's one of those wonderful, you know, and you can argue for either possibility, and that's what happens in a rehearsal period. The actor and the director will argue, and the Desdemona will rise up from the bed and put her two cents in. And, I mean, that's what goes on in a theatrical rehearsal, okay? Arguing these very points. Put out the light, and then put out the light. If I quench thee, thou flaming minister, and again, interesting word, it minister in the sense that the light is serving him. We have the light as the servant. We're back to that theme from the beginning of Act One. The light is serving him because it's allowing him to see. It's ministering to him in that it is providing a chance for him to walk into the dark bedroom and see his wife lying there. If I quench thee, thou flaming minister, I can again thy former light restore, should I repent me. If I put out the candle and it's too dark, I can relight the candle. That's what he's saying. But once put out thy light, he refers to Desdemona now, thou cunningness pattern of excelling nature, I know not where is that Promethean heat that can thy light relume. Once I extinguish the light in Desdemona, the true light that we're suddenly back in the Gospel of St. John, the beginning of St. John, okay? That light that illumines the vision of light and darkness all the way through this speech. Right? It's been wonderful to teach this here at the seminary because I go to Mass and every morning the Mass illuminates the play. It's that sense of Catholic culture, the way it was supposed to be. One thing, I mean, it's just, it is integral. Yeah. That image pattern is working through here. Point being, I extinguish your light, I can never re-illumine. Not even if Prometheus were to come from heaven again, bring the torch from heaven again, that wouldn't be enough to re-loom the light. That light in the eye, the human light, that will be gone. That's there for one time. You put it out, it's gone forever. When I have plucked the rose, I cannot give it vital grace. There's the reason. It didn't occur to me. That's why he enters with the rose. That's why he enters with the rose. He's preparing for that line in Act 5. Okay. Question answered. this is why you have to stick to the text. When I have plucked the rose, I cannot give it vital growth again. You can't go and try to reattach the flower to the flower stem and hope it'll grow some more. Won't work. Again, it's a one-shot deal. You got one chance to pluck the rose. When I have plucked the rose, I cannot give it vital growth again. It needs must wither. I'll smell thee on the tree. He kisses her. O balmy breath that dost almost persuade justice to break her sword. He is the instrument of justice. And justice's sword is about to strike, but having kissed his wife, the beauty of her breath almost dissuades him. This is glorious writing. Beautiful poetry. This is heartbreaking. One more. One more. Be thus when thou art dead, and I will kill thee and love thee after. Which is what's going to happen, but he doesn't understand what he's saying. And again, there is that vision. It connects with the speech he made when he arrived in Cyprus. I fear that such a perfect moment follows not again. Okay, and if I could die now, I'd be happy. That vision of death has consumed him all along. One more, and that's the last. So sweet was ne'er so fatal. I must weep, and he's overcome, but they are cruel tears. This sorrow's heavenly, it strikes where it doth love. If before he viewed himself as the personification of justice, he now views himself as godlike. Who was it that was so just that he had to kill that he loved? God himself, who killed his son. This sorrow's heavenly. It strikes where it doth love. The Father loved the Son, but allowed that Son to suffer and die on the... It's the remnants of that faith are still in his mind. But again, please notice, we have clear analysis. He knows what he's doing. He's following through. There is an argument. He claims he is standing for justice. He's wrong. Now, I'm not going to follow through the little scene. You saw it. There's much to say about it, but I'm not going to go through it. My point being, Othello enters in Act 5, Scene 2, standing for justice, attempting to be the arm of justice. Okay? I want to move ahead now. The next speech, after her death, and indeed, following the moment when the revelation has come, his eyes have been opened, and he knows the truth. This is about line 260 here. Right after the death of Amelia. It comes right after the death of Amelia, if you're looking for it. He has been disarmed. He goes and finds another weapon in the chamber, a sword of Spain, the ice brook's temper. There's the coldness imagery again. This was tempered in cold water, this sword. Oh, here it is, uncle, I must come forth. If thou attempt it, it will cost thee dear. Thou hast no weapon, and perforce must suffer. Look in upon me then and speak with me, or naked as I am, I will assault thee. Enter Gratiano. What is the matter? Here's the next speech. Behold, I have a weapon. He found another weapon in the chamber. He's holding it, okay? A better never did this itself sustain upon a soldier's thigh. I have as good a weapon as any soldier ever had. Notice in saying that, what is he implying about himself at this moment? He's a soldier again. He is a soldier. He has a weapon. I have seen the day that with this little arm and this good sword, I have made my way through more impediments than 20 times your stop. Look, old man, you can't stop me if I want to get out of this chamber. Line up 20 of you, and I can cut my way through it. But, oh, vain boast. Who can control his fate? I'm not that man now. It's over. Look what I've come to. Look what I've come to. 'Tis not so now. Be not afraid, though you do see me weaponed. Here is my journey's end. Here is my butt. And very sea mark of my utmost sail. Ah. We've been on a journey. It's come to an end. Okay. This is the stopping place. This is the target. But is a reference to target. Everybody's taken a shot at me. I'm the target. This is the end. And then the sail image, which takes us back to that storm. Okay. We've come through yet another storm and we've landed. This is it. We're there now. We're finished. Do you go back dismayed? 'Tis a lost fear. Don't be afraid. Don't waste your time fearing. I told you, this is it. I'm not going to do anything. Man but a rush against Othello's breast, and he retires. The point I was making to Father Fullerton earlier, that it's his occupation's gone to the point now that you just take one of those little, just a reed, poke him in the chest, and he's finished. There's no strength left in him. He may have this sword. It may look impressive. He's been drained of any energy of the warrior. There's nothing left of him. Man but a rush against Othello's breast, and he retires. Where should Othello go? So I leave this room. Where do I go? Can't stay on Cyprus. Can't go back to Venice. Can't return to my native land. There's nowhere left for him. His whole world is now reduced to this room because that room has decided his fate. So in a sense, he's locked there. He's trapped there. It is the end for him. He acknowledges that. Having said that, where should Othello go? The reason he can go nowhere is defined by the fact of the murder, and he now knows it's a murder. His eyes are open. He looks, therefore, at that which now defines him. He looks at his wife's dead body. Now, how dost thou look now? He turns, he's speaking to Gratiano, point being, there's a reason he turns and looks at her at this point. O ill-starred wench. Boy, were you unlucky. Boy, were you unfortunate. But notice who he's blaming at this point. Those stars. It was fortune. It was fate. A little bit of an attempt to, okay, withdraw responsibility. Pale as thy smock. Again, the whiteness. As white as the white gown she's wearing. Here we go. When we shall meet at Compt, Compt meaning judgment day. When the day of judgment dawns and we have to meet, this look of thine will hurl my soul from heaven and fiends will snatch at it. Now, what's the look? Desdemona is dead. That look on judgment day, he's not talking about facing the judge. Although there will be, notice, justice is still on his mind. On judgment day, he, of course there will be justice, but at that moment he is not fearing the judge. He is fearing the look on Desdemona's face. And he says, it is the look I see now, this look of thine. She's not judging him. She's dead. The look is not of the angry wife at the husband, why did you kill me? The look is the look of innocence, purity, goodness. As she lies dead, he sees the reflection of what she actually was. At the moment of judgment, he will see goodness, God's goodness reflected in her face, and what will hurl him downward is the good, is the beautiful, is the true. Desdemona, in that sense, he now sees as a reflection of that divine, of that absolute divine, this look of thine will hurl my soul from heaven. What's he admitting? On judgment day, my soul will have no place in heaven. He is admitting he is damned. Look, let me make the O.J. comparison. This is an honest man who won't lie about what he did. He's admitted to the crime. And not only has he admitted to the crime, at this moment he is saying, I know the result of that crime. I have damned my own soul. I had a choice. I chose damnation. And that's what I will get. And that's what I deserve. And let's face it. There is something honorable in admitting that. Nevertheless, the fact is, it was his choice. He committed the act. We're back, this is where the medieval world enters Shakespeare. What is he acknowledging? What Dante insists in the Inferno. The damned choose hell. Othello's choice has been hell. He has chosen hell. And he now says he deserves hell. Because all he has to do is look in her face and he sees why he deserves it. This look of thine will hurl my soul from heaven and fiends will snatch at it. He touches her cold. Cold, my girl, even like thy chastity. Remember that moment right after the temptation scene begins when he takes her hand and says, hot, hot and moist. And that hot, moist palm was supposed to be a sign of the lascivious nature. It was a false accusation. She's dead now, but he takes the palm and says, it's cold, it's chaste. An honest recognition. Oh, cursed, cursed slave! Now the recognition. He was the slave, Iago was the master. The devil mastered him, and he has been a slave. And he has been a slave, and he is cursed. He is cursed. Now, notice the rest of this speech. Whip me, ye devils, from the possession of this heavenly sight. The damned soul could not bear heaven. This is the damned soul calling on the devils to remove him from heaven because the thought of spending eternity looking at her goodness when he knows he destroyed it is unthinkable. Don't let me look at her anymore. I can't bear it. The damned soul cries out for hell because heaven would be unbearable having come to the full knowledge that you chose your own damnation. You rejected the good. It's that idea, and it's a long-standing idea, that there is that enormous gulf between heaven and hell, and the damned soul has no place in heaven, couldn't exist there. It has rejected all that. It has rejected love. It has rejected God. It has rejected truth, and therefore must be in hell. And that's what Othello calls for. But in calling for it, what do we have again? A moment of human awareness. Whip me, ye devils, from the possession of this heavenly sight. Don't let me look on this glimpse of heaven anymore. I can't bear it. Blow me about in winds. Roast me in sulfur. Wash me in steep down gulfs of liquid fire. Oh, Desdemone, dead, Desdemone, dead. Oh. You have the howls of the damned soul. We are hearing there what Dante and Virgil hear as they descend into the inferno. Because after the moment of judgment, with full clarity, full knowledge, those damned souls will know what they rejected. And howl in agony. But please notice, what else is he calling for? He's calling for that vision of what hell is. Being blown about in winds. Remember those adulterous souls, Francesco and Paola, who are blown about in the winds? He's calling to be roasted in sulfur. He wants to be one of those that is indeed being, you know, in the inferno, it's the river of boiling blood where the murderers are. But he wants to be roasted in sulfur, washed in steeped down gulfs of liquid fire. The internal pain of the soul is so great that it demands exterior pain in order to allow it to forget or to match physical agony with the agony of soul. And the damned soul cries out for the torments of hell. Shakespeare knew it. Othello knows it. He's calling for all of that. And then the reason is, he again looks at her and sees that she is dead and knows he did it. And he ends by wailing. Oh, inarticulate howling. Just one thing as we head into the last speech. It's a great moment. I don't know if you got the reference. They bring Iago in again, and Othello says, I look down towards his feet, but that's a fable. The notion was that the devil had cloven hooves. So Othello looks down at Iago's feet and expects to see cloven hooves if he's really the devil. But he seems to have feet like an ordinary man, therefore that's got to be a fable. Because what he's saying is, this man is the devil. This is the devil standing before me. And then, boy, this is heartbreaking. He asks pardon of Cassio. Lodovico says, I'm about line 295. Did you and he consent in Cassio's death? Othello says, I. Cassio says, dear general, I never gave you cause. It is the cause. It is the cause. The word comes back at him. It comes out of Cassio's mouth. I never gave you cause. That's got to hurt. Because there was no cause to kill his wife either. He never had any cause for any of these actions. Dear general, I never gave you cause. Othello says, I do believe it. And I ask your pardon. Will you, I pray, demand that demi-devil why he hath thus ensnared my soul and body? Notice soul and body are together once again. There's that unity that I claimed was split apart earlier in the play. It's there now. He ensnared my soul. He ensnared my body, too. Body and soul are one. But they've been ensnared by, and notice the net image, snare image. He's now aware of what Iago did. He's using the metaphor. That's exactly what Iago did. And the response is, these are Iago's last words, demand me nothing, what you know, from this time forth I never will speak word. And he doesn't, that's his last line. Notice, Iago's the only principal character who survives the play. Cassio survives, somebody's got a rule. Iago survives. You can wound evil, but you're never gonna, you can't eliminate it. You can't get rid of it. It seems as though, this is frightening. The play seems to be saying, you can kill the good. You can demolish the good, but evil's still gonna survive. You can only wound evil. It's still gonna be hanging around. From this time forth, I never will speak word. What, not to pray? Torments will ope your lips. And then he's hauled out. Did you notice what Frank Finlay did when he was hauled out? It's a wonderful image of evil. His body just twisted up as they hauled him out. And he started whining. Suddenly, oh, you poor baby. Ugh, it's awful exit. Now, the very last speech. The very last speech. Othello's last. He's going to be held prisoner. They have to inform Venice what's happened. Soft you a word or two before you go. Please notice the humility with which that speech begins. Look, I don't want to bother you guys. You have to go do your business, I understand, but just give me one last word. Soft you a word or two before you go. I have done the state some service and they know it. It's a fact, but he's not boasting. He's not boasting, just a simple statement of fact. I have done the state some service and they know it. No more of that. I pray you, in your letters, when you shall these unlucky deeds relate, speak of me as I am. Nothing extenuate. Don't go out of your way to make excuses. Don't try to excuse my behavior. Nor set down aught in malice. Don't be too filled with anger at me. What's he calling for? Moderation. You have to go tell what happened here, but be moderate about it. Tell the whole truth. Don't leave anything out. But in spite of what I did, don't be malicious toward me. Why? Because if you're malicious toward me, we've entered the realm of which character? Iago. If you overdo it, and I know there's a temptation to overdo it, then you'll become a little like Iago. Just tell the truth and tell it balanced. Notice the wisdom of that. There's wisdom here. There's wisdom here. Then must you speak of one that loved not wisely, but too well. Of one not easily jealous, but being wrought, perplexed in the extreme. I loved too much. I wasn't easily jealous, but once that jealousy took, it went out of bounds, out of control, which is true, that's the point. Once the passion got going in me, I was a man who became overly passionate and lost all control. We are getting clear analysis of the man himself from the man. He has learned. He knows himself. And the result is you want to do what is appropriate at the end of a tragedy is shake the hero and say, well, why didn't you know this three acts before? A lot of good it does now at the act five with the stage scattered with bodies. You're right, but you're too late. But again, that's the whole point of tragedy. We have to go through all that before we learn the lesson. It all has to be broken away and stripped down, and we're too proud. I'll quote my Solzhenitsyn line again. Can't hear it too often. Pride grows on the human heart like lard on a pig. And we just think well of ourselves, and we won't learn lessons, and we think we're fine until suddenly, boom, and then it's, oh yeah, now I see. Now that I've done my damage, now I see. of one whose hand, like the base, look at your text. I've got Judea, and I'll talk about it in a moment, threw a pearl away richer than all his tribe. There's the pearl imagery. It comes at this crucial moment. We've got two different words. I've spoken of this to some of you before. We have two texts of Othello. One which is called the quarto text, a little individual copy that was printed shortly after the play premiered because it was very popular. Therefore, people wanted to buy a copy. So it's called a quarto because they folded the sheet of paper four times, cut it, printed on it, bound it together. You know, get your copy. Here it is, hot off the presses. Today's big hit, Othello. Oh, yeah, I'll buy one of those. That was good. Okay. And then we have the folio text, 1623, 7 years after Shakespeare's death. His friends put together a complete works and publish all the works in one big book. And that's our other copy of the Othello text. And there are differences between the two. There are changes between the two. And in the little quarto, the word is Indian. Like the base Indian threw a pearl away richer than all his tribe. And the image we get is someone, notice, a foreigner, an outsider, who is out fishing for and gets a pearl and doesn't recognize it and throws it away. And some editors take that reading because it is, the Indian is like the Moor, who was an outsider who didn't understand, who was ignorant and lost it. The folio text says Judean. And we know who that is. Okay? What happened? It's a reference to the ultimate betrayer. The ultimate betrayer. And now we don't have an actual thing of fishing and getting a pearl and throwing it away. The pearl that's thrown away was our Lord himself. The betrayal came through a kiss. The betrayal came through a kiss. And the betrayer then, out of horror at what he's done, commits suicide, which Othello is about to do. Now, editors quarrel back and forth. Some will print one, some will print the other. It may even be that Shakespeare changed it between times. I don't know. My guess is the printer of the quarto got the word wrong, misread it. Because even when it appears in the folio, it's written this way. So the printer could have had the copy before him as publishing the quarto and read that as Indian. Misread it as Indian. And it was corrected when the folio was printed. We don't know. This is the sort of thing Shakespeare scholars sit around and speak about at length without really understanding. We don't know for certain. In any case, if I were doing my version of Othello, it would be Judean, because the ramifications are much larger, okay? Much larger. And especially given the fact that we had the earlier image, this sorrow's heavenly, it strikes where it doth love. He has entered this scene thinking, I am like God, about to kill that whom the one I love. And instead, at the end, he discovers, I'm like someone else. It's a different kind of killing. It's a different betrayal. Of one whose hand, like the base Judean, threw a pearl away richer than all his tribe, of one whose subdued eyes, albeit unused to the melting mood, drops tears as fast as the Arabian trees, their medicinable gum. I was a soldier. I wasn't used to crying. I had never wept. Okay? These eyes weren't used to crying. But now, drops tears as fast as those Arabian trees drop their liquids. But notice he's back sort of again to an image from where he came from. Which leads us to the following peculiar lines. Set you down this, and say besides that in Aleppo once, where a malignant and a turbaned Turk beat a Venetian and traduced the state, I took by the throat the circumcised dog and smote him thus. There was once a time in Aleppo where I saw a malignant and turbaned Turk who beat up a Venetian man and betrayed the state of Venice. And I took that dog by the throat, and this is how I killed him. Although earlier in the speech he just said, I have done the state some service, they know it, no more of that. I'm not going to talk anymore about the service I did the state. Then why does he end with those lines? The reason is this. In that final image, I think, we have the man talking about himself and giving a final, accurate, clear portrait of who he was and what the problem was. Say besides that in Aleppo once, and he sets it in Aleppo, it's actually taken place here in Cyprus, a barbarian, a malignant and turbaned Turk, one who represents all that attempts to destroy civilization, that's what he had become. That's what he had become. Beat a Venetian and traduce the state. Who's the Venetian? The Othello of Act One. The defender of the state, who was a Venetian. I, in my worst character, took on myself at my best. And in doing so, I traduced the state. I became a Turk. I became a Turk, and I beat the Venetian out of me. An admission of this divided nature that's haunted him through the whole play. And a recognition of what he sank to. Remember when he was awakened in the night when Cassio got drunk and he said, what? What do we do to ourselves what God hath forbid the Turks? That's exactly what he's done. He's become a Turk. Where a malignant and a turbaned Turk beat a Venetian and traduced the state, I took by the throat the circumcised dog. Who does he grab? Which throat? His own, because he's both of them. He is now both the one punished and the punisher. I took by the throat the circumcised dog and smote him thus, and he plunges the knife into himself. He enters as a force of justice. He dies as a force of justice. But unlike the first case where he misread completely and punished the innocent, he is now claiming, I was a divided man. And it is time for all that is good in me to now punish all that is evil in me. And he kills himself. And smote him thus. How does Othello die? As a defender of the state of Venice. He ends as he began. He has a little moment of glory at the end, but we can't call it glory because he's a suicide. And if he's being a Venetian, we know what that... It is an... Yes, he's done something good. No, it's not good. It's still a suicide. I kissed thee ere I killed thee, he says. Last couplet, final couplet. We end with a couplet. The couplets were in the couplets in the first act didn't work. They were used for humor. Here he ends with a couplet. Balance, even to the point where the words are balanced within the lines. I kissed thee ere I killed thee. No way but this. Killing myself to die upon a kiss. And what the couplet does at the end is link love and death. Two things that are linked in a frightening way and have been in this play. The last word is kiss. The last action is he kisses his bride and they are joined in death. He has killed both of them. He dies with full awareness of what he's done. End of play. And if you're looking at it clearly, I mean, the sense in the room that night as the production ended was absolutely appropriate. You have lived through something that's just appalling, but you haven't had to live through it. There is a, we can't call it, you know, delight. We can't call it entertainment. But it is a profound story that we have watched and that has moved us, and we take a lesson from it. Now again, I want to go back to what His Excellency said as we began all this on Monday. Literature stands as itself, and it should be taken as itself to support the faith. This is not a nice, happy little sentimental story that will teach us a nice little more. It's not that. This is a powerful representation of the way life is lived. If we cleaned this up and made it nice and taught the lesson simply and in a pleasant way, the lesson wouldn't get home. Being honest and truthful about the way original sin affects human beings and showing it to us with some artistry so we have some distance, but at the same time, honestly enough to pull us in so we experience it, we learn. And they are hard lessons, but you need to know them. Especially those of you who are priests or going into the priesthood. This is real life. And because of the fallen state of the world and the fallen state of man, this stuff happens. Fortunately, not always to this degree, although it's a possibility and you can run into it at any time, but the tensions that shove in that direction are there. And if Iago is a modern man, and as we said, in a way Iago is now everywhere, get ready for more of this, and you have to know how to deal with it. And putting a happy face on it won't work. Pretending it's not there won't work. Pretending you can sit down and in a 10-minute counseling session clear it all up is foolish. Because you're dealing with human passions out of control. You're dealing with human beings who are complicated. But the one reason for reading literature is to give you some wisdom so you can appreciate the complexity and the profundity and have some idea of at least what you're confronted with. Literature should support you in your mission. Your mission is more important. These are created characters. Othello is not right now in hell. He didn't exist. He's an imaginary character. But you are going to deal with real souls who have the potential to go to hell. Which is why your mission is much more important than reading plays or putting on plays or looking at plays. But through that activity, you can gain some insight into what you need to do or what you might be confronted with or what the problems are to help you assist so that an Othello doesn't go to hell. So that you won't be taken in by an Iago who's wandering around doing who knows what in your parish. So that you can recognize the goodness in a Desdemona who may be headstrong, and you want to just toss her out and not deal with her, but realize that there is something good there, or an Amelia, or a Cassio. These are people you're going to run into because Shakespeare's created real human beings. These characters are real. You need to know them. You will not have a parish filled with saints, which means your task isn't going to be easy. My vocation is teaching Shakespeare. That's what I was given to do. So I have a special love for this man. And I'm here to tell you about that because I think he can be helpful to you. Because I view him as the greatest truth teller. The one who knew more about the world and told it more truthfully than anyone else. But if you leap ahead to his last play, The Tempest, he himself was wise enough so that in the epilogue to his last play, he asks for prayers for himself. And now my ending is despair unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free. The last things he wrote were a little adaptation of lines from the Lord's Prayer. And his last cry as a playwright was, "Help me to save my soul." Which means the playwright had the good sense to know that finally what was most important was that he, as playwright, William Shakespeare, save his own soul. That's his first duty. That's what you're out there to do, and there may not, who knows, there may be a budding Shakespeare in one of your parishes. Encourage him in his talent, but always keep clear. First, foremost, last, the salvation of souls. It's been a busy week. I suspect what Shakespeare was hoping to do was squeak into purgatory. That's what I say I'm hoping to do. Hoping to squeak into purgatory. So on Monday, we'll go there and take a look.